Are these closures getting at the problem, getting at the place that the disease was spreading? For example, is there evidence of community spread on the beaches?
That's the issue, because the beaches are outside. You're separated 6 feet or more, especially if you're surfing or on the beach itself. The pushback has been, we're not contracting the disease at the beach. We're all 6 feet apart. We're exercising in the sunlight. We do know that the bars and restaurants, have a much more difficult time keeping that spacing, having people wear their face coverings. But the move is a move to keep us all safe and protected. If it does what it's supposed to do, numbers drop down, then we're all better for it.
Do you feel that this is the pattern you're going to have to maintain for the next year? Sometimes things will be open, sometimes you have to shut them back down.
And talking in Governor Newsom's office, along with LA County Health Department, Dr. Barbara Frere, no, we think that we can get past this and see this mini surge and see where we are in 3 weeks. Hopefully we can get back to a near normal summertime outside experience. If not, we'll get through along it takes, and hopefully when this will knock it down before we expect the fall to get here.
Have you been a little frustrated looking across at the European Union and seeing how they've gotten their cases down for the continent to a few thousand a day, and here we are in the United States at tens of thousands a day with a warning of 100,000 a day?
Yes, it is frustrating to see it, and I'm disappointed when I see people walking outside in public with others around them not wearing face coverings. And that's just a microcosm of what we see all across the country.
Richard Montgomery is the mayor of Manhattan Beach, California. Let's bring another voice into the conversation, Dr. Ali Khan. He is Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dr. Khan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
I just want to note, California beat down their number of cases. They were a success story. Mayor Montgomery told us he thought they had a good number of months before a second wave and was surprised to be shut down so quickly. Are you surprised?
Not at all, and I would not characterize what happened in California, what happened in the United States, as a success story. Clearly, after our initial peak of about 35,000 cases, we started to come down a little bit, but our response was stalled and stagnant for 4 to 6 weeks. And we failed to ever contain the outbreak, so it's very predictable that we would continue to see increasing cases.
So even the states that got on this early, relatively speaking, did not get on it early enough. That's what you're telling me?
Oh, absolutely. We never contained this outbreak in the United States. So we continue to have 20,000 cases a day for 4 to 6 weeks through May and June. And if you fail to contain the outbreaks, I characterize it like embers of a fire. There's a little ember left that can restart your forest fire, and that's exactly what we're seeing happening now across the United States. I mean, you just heard the experience in California. There's, I believe, 23 states currently that are backing up their reopening plans, and 38 states that have an increased number of cases.
Well, Dr. Khan, stay with us, because we now turn to a state that seems at the moment to be doing better. As California is reclosing beaches, Illinois is preparing to open some of the beaches along Lake Michigan because their case numbers seem to have gone considerably down. We called Dr. Emily Landon, who advises the Illinois government. So what seems to be working in Illinois?
Well, Illinois took a lot of steps early on to try and control the spread of this virus, maybe before it was an emergency to do so. And that's really the right time. I'm convinced that if we hadn't had our stay-at-home order on March 21st, that even a week or 2 weeks delay would have put us in the same situation as what we'd seen in the Northeast and in New York City.
Do you find mask use to be pretty widespread if you go out on the streets of Chicago, say?
Well, I think it's not bad here. I think most of the buildings and most of the shops that are open here in Chicago are requiring masks for entry. And I think that's been really important. We were one of the earliest places to require masks back before it became really so much of a political issue. And I think that's really helped Illinois to come along and kind of buy into the mask, at least in Chicago. Now, you'll still see lots of people not wearing masks on the street, but that's because you don't need to wear a mask unless you're really within 6 feet of another person. So if you're out running on the lakefront path, or you're taking a walk with your quarantined family, you know, it's not necessary to wear your mask, but you do need to have one if you want to be close to other people.
So what else besides some beaches will be opening in Illinois in the next few days?
Well, Illinois went into phase four last week, and that means that restaurants, indoor parts of restaurants, are now able to operate at 25% occupancy. Public pools are now allowed to open in some places. And the lakefront path, which had been closed since a very nice day in March, where too many people were out and about gathering, and the mayor very smartly shut that down. Now that's open, and beaches may open soon. Gyms began to open last week. Certainly, these are still risky activities. There's still more infection than we want to be having. But if people are following the rules, keeping distance, wearing their masks, if we can keep doing those things, then it should be safe enough for us to go back to doing some of these things that we used to enjoy before the pandemic.
Now, when I listen to you saying what you think you did right, I hear some similarities between Illinois and California, because California, as you know, also said, hey, we were on this early, we shut down early, we're in a better situation now, we can begin to open up, and now they're having to shut back down again. It turns out that the virus has been there all along and is emerging again.
Yeah.
Is that a cautionary tale for you?
It is. In fact, I've been talking to my friends and colleagues and saying, we need to understand better what's happened in California. But with respiratory viruses and with infection in general, there's kind of a tipping point that happens when every case is able to spread to one or more other people on average. Then you have to do some very drastic things like a stay-at-home order or really closing down a lot of public buildings and activities. So I don't know exactly what's putting California back into this situation, but I do know that if they do the same things that they did before, that it should be successful in curbing the spread of the virus.
Dr. Emily Landon is Chief Infectious Disease Epidemiologist at the University of Chicago Medical School and has been advising the governor of Illinois. Now, Dr. Ali Khan is still with us at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Khan, do you sense that state and local officials are learning and even learning from each other as some suffer setbacks?
Oh, not at all. And with due respect to Dr. Landon, I don't believe the data supports that Illinois is doing better. Mid-June, I think there were 550 cases, and I believe yesterday there were 800 cases. So another cautionary tale, which is that unless you get your outbreak under control, you will see an increase in cases when you open up. So we'll see the exact same thing probably happen here. But what we're seeing here is this is now being shifted, and I've seen this now multiple places. We're shifting the blame to individuals not doing what they're supposed to be doing. I've not heard one person talk about test and trace. And so if you're gonna reopen, what are you doing to get cases down to zero? So no metrics, how much, you know, how soon does it take to isolate somebody? How many contacts are people following? How many cases are from contact lists? So no, we cannot go back to what we did before successfully, because we were not a success before, because we had failed to do test and trace. So there's four elements of getting this disease under control. So yes, one is the community component, which is wear your mask, social distance, and wash your hands. That's just one component, and it's not the primary component. The primary component is the state and the localities and the national responsibility to get cases down, test and trace. Add that to leadership, and then add that to dropping deaths with dexamethasone. Those are four things we need to do to become a success, just like Europe and countries like New Zealand that have eliminated the disease, so they have zero cases. And China has two cases and 1.4 billion people. We can do this in America.
Dr. Ali Khan, thanks for the insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Steve. Mask on.
Thank you. He is the Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:19 right now, and you're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is Friday. Later this hour, we'll have Wisconsin Live for you. Music stages across Wisconsin have been silent since March as the pandemic forced venues to close. That moved artists to mostly virtual stages. Now some venues are starting to bring live music back with smaller audiences and precautions in place. Wisconsin Live in 25 minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember comic, actor, writer, and director Carl Reiner, who died Monday at age 98. He created the Dick Van Dyke Show and started off as a writer and performer on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. We'll listen back to interviews from our archive with Reiner and his friend Mel Brooks. And TV critic David Bianculli will have a tribute. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Earl M. Terry Endowment Fund, a permanent endowment that provides ongoing support to sustain the present and future operation of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from UW Parkside, offering a master's degree in biological sciences, covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. With a 90% placement rate, graduates become leaders in a field that's shaping the future. Details at uwp.edu.
Into the weekend, some patchy dense fog this morning, then mostly sunny and hot, a slight chance of afternoon thundershowers in the south, and highs in the upper 70s in the north, around 90 in the rest of the state. For Saturday, Independence Day, sunny and hot, temperatures around 90.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware at iDrive.com/NPR. From Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century, 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at JonesDay.com. And from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. As we get ready for the 4th of July tomorrow, we're remembering a remarkable speech about Independence Day. In July of 1852, in Rochester, New York, a crowd of about 600 people gathered together in a hall. They'd been brought together by the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society. Their guest speaker was Frederick Douglass. Douglass had been born enslaved. He'd secretly taught himself to read and write. He was a genius who became one of the best-known abolitionists and thinkers in the world. The speech that Douglass gave before that crowd in Rochester was called "What to the Slave is the 4th of July." Yale historian David Blight says it was one of the most riveting and compelling speeches Douglass ever gave.
This speech is a symphony with three movements. First movement, he sets them at ease by honoring the Founding Fathers. He calls the Declaration of Independence the ring bolt of American liberty. He calls the 4th of July the American Passover. He sets them all at ease, but then he takes them through a litany of all the horrors of the slave trade, of the slave ships, of slave auction blocks. He takes that audience to the dark heart of what slavery really is. And then that middle movement, he says, "Oh, be warned, there is a horrible reptile coiled up at your nation's heart." And then he ends, and the last movement of the speech, he says, "Your nation is still young, it is still malleable, changeable, it's not quite too late, you might yet have a chance to save yourselves." This speech is a rhetorical masterpiece, and its great theme is American secular and religious hypocrisy for the practice of slavery. And it is a great warning that if the country doesn't find a way to face this problem, it will face tremendous disruption, tremendous violence. Today, it will remind people so much of the current crisis we're in, and this everlasting problem that we never quite are able to solve, the question of race.
As you said, he doesn't start this speech with a condemnation. He starts with a compliment. The Founding Fathers, he says, were great men. They were statesmen, patriots, heroes. Why does he begin that way?
Well, he's setting his audience in a safe place. Also, he meant what he said. He called the principles of the Declaration saving principles. equality, the natural rights tradition, popular sovereignty, which means a republican form of government, and the right of revolution. And he says, look, these were geniuses who created this republic out of the 18th century. But then, of course, the rhetoric begins to shift. And in that middle of that speech, it is almost like a hailstorm. It's like he's raining down thunder and hail on his audience. And I have to believe some of them were squirming. And where you see it is how often he uses the pronouns you and your. It's your nation, your founders, your Declaration of Independence, you and your, and you and your. He's separating himself already and says, I quote, "The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. The 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony."
Was this speech a gutsy move, or because he was in front of a friendly audience, was it extraordinary but not particularly brave?
It was a gutsy move. Even if you're speaking to a crowd essentially of your like-minded friends, this is still a very poignant attack on anyone who considered themselves a patriotic American. What Douglass is really doing here is pointing to America's creeds, its first principles. They're right there in the Declaration of Independence. He says, you know, you've got the document. The principles are terrific. It's the practice that violates it all.
Have you ever thought, having spent so much time thinking about Frederick Douglass, if he were alive today, what he'd be doing and what he might say in his speeches, in a speech like this one?
This much we know about his character. He would never miss using a crisis.
Huh.
When something shocking happened, he was a creature of words. He was a genius with language. Douglass would go to words and try first to explain to himself what he thought about it. Then he would go take it out to the public. As for the kind of crisis we're having now, who knows what he would say. But after 130-some years, he'd say, you know, I died in the late 19th century, and you all are still at this? For God's sake. But he also, I think, he'd try to harness young people. He'd be out there trying to harness this energy, and he would be harnessing it into voting. He always believed that somehow the right to vote was at the core of liberty, and he would be out there right now trying to harness them into voting. But what he would be seeing is what we're all seeing, possibly the third great reckoning about this in our history. The first was the Civil War and Reconstruction. The second was the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. And now we're probably having a third one, whatever we're going to end up calling this. But he would be saying, harness this now and try to get it right this time. And he'd warn us that the whole world is watching to see whether this thing called an American Republic can really survive.
Professor David Blight, author of the award-winning book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Noel. It's an honor.
And on NPR.org right now, you can watch an amazing short film featuring five young descendants of Frederick Douglass as they read and respond to excerpts of his famous speech. This is NPR News.
As coronavirus cases soar, the calls for Americans to mask up are getting louder and more urgent.
Please, please, please wear a face covering when you go out in public. It is not a suppression of your freedom.
So just how much can masks help? I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We'll explore that this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered at 4 today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning Edition on WPR. In news, the Department of Public Instruction will now let families who were denied eligibility for school voucher programs reapply. More on that story and all the latest news from NPR and WPR just ahead.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is ordering people in his state to wear face coverings in public spaces amid soaring numbers of coronavirus infections. The state reported more than 7,900 new cases yesterday. The mask order marks a reversal for the Republican governor. He previously said the government could not force individuals to wear them. NPR's Nurit Eisenman says COVID-19 is now spreading rapidly across much of the southern and western U.S.
One metric scientists use to track this pandemic is the number of daily new infections as a percentage of the population. If that figure climbs above a certain threshold, evidence suggests the only way to get a handle on the spread is to revert to stay-at-home mode. Three states are now at that point: Arizona, Florida, and South Carolina. 13 more states are one notch below, most in the south and west, but including Idaho and Iowa. Also, when you drill down to the county level, hotspots emerge in states that are doing better overall: Washington State, South Dakota, and Nebraska. Nurit Eisenman, NPR News.
The federal government is urging but not requiring travelers to wear face coverings on airline flights and in airports. A report from the Departments of Transportation, Health and Human Services, and Homeland Security also encourages airlines to limit seating capacity on planes. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The Department of Public Instruction will now let families who were denied eligibility for school voucher programs reapply. The conservative advocacy group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty sued DPI on behalf of a family that tried to file an amended tax return showing they should be financially eligible for vouchers to send their two kids to private school. DPI and the Department of Revenue now say they'll allow amended applications. Lucas Weber was an attorney representing the family for the lawsuit.
The new policy that's in force, we think, is reflective of what the statute actually requires. And we are hopeful that no other family going forward is going to have to go through the same things that our clients did here.
DPI said they have no legal concerns about families reapplying, and now that the Department of Revenue will process amended tax returns to check eligibility, they'll let families try again. Congress has approved a measure to extend the deadline for the Paycheck Protection Program. PPP, as it's known, provides short-term loans to small businesses that are forgivable under certain circumstances. The program originally ended Tuesday at midnight with about $130 billion left unused. Bill Smith is the Wisconsin State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. He says survey data from the group shows many businesses have already applied for and received federal aid.
But our studies also show that almost half of them are anticipating the need for more financial aid over the next year.
According to figures from the U.S. Small Business Administration, more than 84,000 loans have been approved for Wisconsin businesses under the program, totaling close to $10 billion. The plan to extend the program's deadline now needs approval from President Donald Trump. Wisconsin health officials are urging people to stay home during the 4th of July holiday to help stem a recent surge in coronavirus infections. The state health department said Thursday that nearly 20% of total reported cases in the state have come in the last 2 weeks. The agency says the spike has been driven largely by young people congregating in bars. Overall, the state has seen 29,738 confirmed cases since the pandemic began in March and 793 deaths. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more news on our website at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging science and the arts by supporting books such as Steve Olson's The Apocalypse Factory, about the atomic age, out July 28th. More at sloan.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. A close associate of the financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein is under arrest today. Her name is Ghislaine Maxwell. And just a quick warning that some parts of this story are really disturbing because of the nature of the alleged crimes. Prosecutors say Maxwell helped Epstein sexually exploit underage girls. Epstein died in prison and authorities ruled it a suicide, but the investigation into what he was doing has continued. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been following this story in the meantime. Hey, Ryan.
Good morning.
How did Maxwell and Epstein know each other?
Maxwell comes from a prominent family in the UK. Her father was a media magnate there. And she and Epstein met in the 1990s. They dated for a period of time. But on a broader level, she became a close confidant of his. They had a professional relationship as well. And there have long been allegations in lawsuits brought by Epstein's alleged victims that Maxwell, for years, helped Epstein recruit young girls to be sexually exploited. And even after Epstein's suicide last year, prosecutors said that the investigation, as you noted, continued into his associates and possible co-conspirators. And Maxwell was seen then as a likely person of interest for investigators.
She's facing federal charges now. What are the charges?
She faces six counts in all, including conspiracy to entice minors to travel to engage in sexual acts and conspiracy to transport minors to engage in criminal sexual activity. She also faces perjury charges for allegedly lying about her role in Epstein's activities when she was asked about it under oath during a deposition a couple of years ago.
What are prosecutors saying about what they allege she did?
Well, the events detailed in the indictment took place between 1994 and 1997, and they relate to three underage girls who were allegedly abused by Epstein. Here is how the acting U.S. attorney in Manhattan, Audrey Strauss, summed up Maxwell's role.
Maxwell played a critical role in helping Epstein to identify, befriend, and groom minor victims for abuse. In some cases, Maxwell participated in the abuse herself.
Prosecutors allege that Epstein and Maxwell had a sort of systematic method for luring these young girls in. They would pretend to befriend them by taking them shopping, by taking them to the movies, by asking about their family or their school life. Maxwell would encourage the girls to let Epstein pay for their travel and their education. And prosecutors say that this was all part of a scheme designed to make these young girls feel indebted to Epstein. And once Epstein and Maxwell had developed a rapport with these underage girls, prosecutors say that Maxwell would try to normalize sexual abuse in a couple of ways, by undressing in front of the victim or being present when Epstein was sexually abusing the victim. And in at least one instance, as we heard Strauss say, prosecutors allege that Maxwell participated in the abuse herself.
Okay, so she's arrested now. She's been charged. Does the investigation into Jeffrey Epstein stop here?
This is not the end of the road. The top prosecutor in Manhattan, Audrey Strauss, who I mentioned earlier, said yesterday that this investigation is still ongoing. Of course, this case has generated a ton of public interest, in part because Epstein had ties to a lot of prominent people. That includes Britain's Prince Andrew. And there are questions about what Prince Andrew, for example, and other prominent people, knew about Epstein's activities. As for Maxwell, she has serious charges here, this sort of charges that could induce her to cooperate with prosecutors and share what she knows about other associates of Epstein's.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Many neighborhoods across this country have been crackling with the sound of fireworks. Mine is no exception. Some of these fireworks displays are illegal, and some people would like to call the police. So why would some be reluctant to dial 911? Sally Herships has more from New York.
Let's start by getting a couple of things straight. First, fireworks in New York City, all illegal, at least if you're a consumer. Next, if you're one of the many people thinking, this summer seems louder than others, you're right. According to the NYPD, last year, between January and mid-June, there were about 50 fireworks complaints. This year, there have been 11,500.
It's kind of been a bit like all-consuming, to be honest, because I go to bed hearing it, I get woken up hearing it, and then on my Twitter feed, all anybody's doing is talking about it.
Eric Anderson is 33. He lives in Brooklyn with his girlfriend and his Pomeranian corgi mix, Archie. He says in his neighborhood, the explosions seem to follow a schedule.
Now that we know when they start, we need to hunker down in our bedroom around 9 o'clock. We close the door. I bought like thicker curtains trying to block out some of the noise. I turn the TV as up as loud as I can. I have like three fans in the AC, but when they're that close, you still feel the booms.
Here's a sample. Warning, it's loud. Anderson shot video of the fireworks from his kitchen window. He says he can't tell who's setting them, but there are a lot of conspiracy theories, like that the CIA or police are coordinating an attack on communities of color. Scott Smith is with the National Fireworks Association. He says the reality is simpler. People are just buying a lot of fireworks this year. And Smith wants to squash another rumor. He says these fireworks are not professional grade. Those are barcode tracked. Also, to use them, you need a special tube to launch them safely.
But yes, if that firework was not shot from the proper tube, it would fire almost instantly, right? And it would have nowhere to go.
But for the most part, these fireworks are making their way upwards and infuriating people trying to sleep around the country. One Brooklyn resident emailed to say he's moving after 11 years. The fireworks aggravate his epilepsy. Others wrote about how difficult it is to tolerate loud bangs when you live with PTSD. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says the fireworks are a problem, and the city is going to crack down on suppliers.
We're going to start a huge sting operation to go and get these illegal fireworks at the base.
As for Anderson, he's created a special Twitter handle. He's filed a complaint with New York City's hotline for non-emergency services. But so far, he's stopped short of one step, calling the police. Across the city and uptown on the west side, Cynthia Ceylon is feeling equally frustrated by the nightly fireworks outside her third floor window. But she's also pointedly not calling 911.
A big part of my hesitation was a worry about what an interaction between whoever was setting off these illegal fireworks would be if confronted by the police when our nerves are so raw right now.
Ceylon says she's weighing the lesser of two evils, being bothered by the noise and her dog's nerves versus the possibility that a kid just watching would be mistreated by a rogue cop. She has another worry, too, police not showing up at all.
I have this terrible feeling that there will be cops who would say, it's like, oh, you wanted to defund the police? Well, you deal with this problem.
When asked about unresponsive police, the NYPD didn't respond to a request for comment. For now, Ceylon says she's not calling. She's just hoping that tonight will be better. For NPR News, I'm Sally Herships.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now it's 8:42. Coming up in 9 minutes, we'll hear about a type of discrimination that's overlooked often because it's rooted not in hate, but in love. Our Hidden Brain team asks why good deeds, those we do for spouses or neighbors, can sometimes lead to injustice. Stay with us.
Folk music is a wide genre in the U.S. because a wide variety of folks make it. So in Simply Folk this week, we'll celebrate our nation's birthday with a rainbow of songs, including music from Buffy St. Marie, Los Entzontles, our native daughters Joe Jenks, and this tune from Jake Blunt. Join me, Dan Robinson, for the best in traditional and contemporary folk music this Sunday, 5 to 8 p.m. here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Their staff can answer your questions about pre-planning a meaningful funeral or memorial service. They consider it an honor to serve families in our community since 1931. KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are some of the stories in the news today. A Turkish court is trying in absentia two former aides of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and 18 other Saudi nationals over the 2018 killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Turkish prosecutors earlier this year indicted the 20 Saudi nationals over Khashoggi's grisly killing at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. They're seeking life prison terms. A white couple has been arrested after at least one handgun was pulled on a black woman and her daughters during a videotaped confrontation at a restaurant parking lot in Michigan. Jillian and Eric Wustenberg were charged Thursday with felonious assault. Cell phone video captured the confrontation outside a Chipotle in Orion Township, northwest of Detroit. And more than 100 people gathered in Sheboygan last night to protest the killing of a black man by a police officer. Details of that story and all the latest news from NPR and WPR coming up in 15 minutes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from PGIM. PGIM, the global investment management business of Prudential, provides perspective for investors seeking to outlast today's uncertainty. Learn more at pgim.com. From the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org. And from Americans for the Arts.
It's 8:45 now, time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the return of live music.
Music stages across Wisconsin have been silent since March as the pandemic forced venues to close. This has moved artists to Facebook and other virtual stages. Now, some venues are starting to bring back live music with smaller audiences and precautions in place. Andy Turner visited the Jazz Estate in Milwaukee recently for its reopening.
It's Friday night, and live music is back at the Jazz Estate on Milwaukee's east side. The lights are low, the bartender is pouring drinks, and the band is warming up. But some things are different. There are fewer patrons, and they're all wearing masks, the new required attire. Owner John Dye has been waiting for this night.
A lot of people get their start with live music. A lot of musicians meet with live music. I mean, it really represents more than just an individual show. It's a whole system.
Bars and restaurants are slowly reopening. In mid-June, the Jazz Estate was operating at 25% capacity for the show, which meant only 16 people could be in the venue, including staff and band members. Tickets were $44.
Really, for tonight's show, we're actually only selling 7 tickets. But we figure bringing the music to people is worth it. So it's just something we have to adjust to and hope that it goes to 50% soon.
Dye says he spent the last few weeks figuring how to comply with the requirements to make his venue as safe as possible. Milwaukee's Marcia Daniil Group is playing tonight. The show is also being streamed live on Facebook. The group was scheduled to play here before the pandemic. Marcia Daniil says it felt great to be back in front of a live audience and with band members she had not seen in months.
As musicians, we thrive off of the energy, you know, that we get from people in the audience, and we especially thrive off of the energy that we get from the people that we're on stage with.
Barbara Wanza of Black Arts MKE attended the show. She says she didn't plan on going out so soon after stay-at-home orders were lifted, but she wanted to support a friend who was performing. Wanza says paying higher ticket prices because of social distancing limitations does not bother her.
I think it could keep some people away. It would not keep me away personally. I'm a big supporter of local talent, especially local African-American talent. And, you know, I'd do just about anything to support them, as long as I can be safe.
Bartender Jeff Kinder admits it felt a little strange to be back behind the bar.
Just the vibe from other bartenders I've gotten on the block, it's everyone misses it, but it's just such a weird feeling re-entering this kind of work right now.
Despite that sense of weirdness, Kinder says he was happy to see some familiar faces and realize now how much he had missed certain aspects of his job.
When you shake a drink really good and you crack a tin open, you hear like, it's like these bubbles coming out of the tin. And it's hands down one of my favorite sounds in the world. You just know you did it right.
The economic fallout from the pandemic has hit Dye especially hard as the owner of two other establishments in Milwaukee, Brian's Cocktail Lounge and At Random. Dye says the Jazz Estate will continue having shows until it does not make sense to anymore.
But there's a little bit of it that's just bringing a service of bringing the music back. And obviously, this isn't really about any kind of profit or anything, though that is important, and not having that income is scary, but it's also important to have music and life and energy.
Dye says he knows how important venues like the Jazz Estate are for musicians. While restaurants, bars, and stores continue to reopen, many performance venues are likely to be among the last to reopen.
Andy Turner is a freelance journalist, college English instructor, and radio DJ living in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center, now offering grocery delivery for Kenosha County seniors 60 plus and those with a disability. Simply call and place your online order via phone with their staff and schedule a free delivery. Check or card accepted. Call 605-6646 to set an appointment.
Doric Context. As long as you still have questions, we will keep asking them. So be connected. Listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Classical Music with Stephanie Elkins is on the way shortly after 9, following a news update from NPR and WPR. And here's what the weather looks like today. Mostly sunny and hot. There's a slight chance of afternoon thunderstorms in the south. Highs in the upper 70s in the north and around 90 for the rest of the state. Sunny and hot tomorrow. Temperatures around 90 degrees.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. When we talk about discrimination, we typically think of people denied something because of who they are, some defining trait. What we can overlook is a different kind of discrimination, which comes from love. NPR Shankar Vedantam asks why good deeds, those we do on behalf of our spouses or our neighbors, can sometimes lead to injustice.
Thought experiments in philosophy usually don't go viral, but there's one that has.
The trolley problem has become a kind of meme.
This is Joshua Green.
I'm a professor in the psychology department at Harvard University, and I study moral decision-making and high-level cognition.
Green has researched how people respond to the trolley problem. Here's the classic version of the thought experiment.
The trolley is headed towards five people, but you can hit a switch that will turn it onto a sidetrack where it will only kill one person. And the question is it okay to hit the switch to minimize the loss of life?
Many people find this moral dilemma painful, but will tell you, yes. Killing one stranger is the right thing to do if it will save five. There's a version of the trolley problem that's even more painful. It forces us to reckon with a bias that we usually don't see as a problem, the bias to care about the people we love above all others. In this version of the thought experiment, five strangers will be saved if you sacrifice someone you know and love, maybe even your own child. Hannah Groch-Begley and Dylan Matthews have discussed this moral dilemma in their relationship. They've come to very different conclusions.
I would save the child. I would easily kill five people on behalf of my own child. I know that, and I'm not a mother. I just know that that's the kind of mother I would be.
And Matthews?
I would kill the kid. Yeah, I wouldn't even question it. Like, it's five against one. I would probably kill myself after out of grief, and so it would be five against two. But, yeah, those people are all the heroes of their own stories, and they all have loved ones who love them as much as I love the kid. And it seems obscene to me to treat my attachment as paramount above their attachments and their lives.
The differences in the couple's moral intuitions became clear even on their very first date in 2015. That night, at a bar in Washington, D.C., their flirting took the form of a debate over moral philosophy. Matthews explained that he believed in maximizing happiness in the world. That requires treating everyone's happiness as equally important, whether that person happens to live on your block or on the other side of the world.
Which I thought was wild and insane. And I was raised to really think about the person who's in front of you, your family members, to think about your friends, and to think about how can I put them first? How can I always be there for them?
Their differences in opinion became an energizing force until about 6 months into their relationship.
I think that it became more difficult for me when it became more concrete.
Concrete because Matthews had decided to donate one of his kidneys to a stranger. His logic was straightforward.
There are people who are dying, and one of them needs a kidney, and this will go to one of them.
To Matthews, not giving away his kidney was like hoarding food he'd never eat while others were hungry. Groch Begley saw it very differently.
There were moments when I was very scared that this person who I was starting to love was going to potentially put themselves in a great deal of danger. It is a very safe procedure, but I'm not a doctor, so you tell me, oh, you're going to remove a major organ, elective surgery, I don't understand why you would do that.
Matthews went ahead with the surgery. Afterward, the National Kidney Registry honored him with a trophy.
It's hefty. It's one of the better obelisks I've received in my life.
For Groch Begley and Matthews, this may have started as an intellectual debate, but their different moral frameworks guide important decisions, like where to donate their money or whether to give up a kidney. And those decisions affect the lives of other people. All of us grapple with similar moral questions, whether we recognize it or not. Very often, like Groch Begley, we prioritize caring for the people we know. Other times, like Matthews, we try to be impartial. Joshua Green, the psychologist, compares these different types of moral reasoning to settings on a camera. Our default response to prioritize the people we know well is like a camera's automatic settings.
So if I want to take a picture of a mountain from a mile away, then I put it in landscape setting and click, point and shoot, and I've got a pretty good picture of a mountain from far away. Occasionally, I get ambitious and will want to do something fancy and maybe have something slightly out of focus and off to the side and who knows, right? And so there you'd put the camera in manual mode.
Each of these modes has benefits. The automatic mode, both on a camera and in our minds, is efficient.
When it comes to the ethics of everyday life, the basic things that everybody should know not to do, the lying, stealing, cheating kinds of things, we want to have automatic settings that just say, nope, 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 can't do that.
These moral instincts make it possible for us to cooperate with the people around us.
But then sometimes life is complicated and sometimes there are difficult trade-offs. And then that's when you want to shift into manual mode.
The manual mode's advantage is that it's flexible. It helps when you have to weigh harming someone you know versus helping several people you don't. We need both modes. But Green points out that our fast, intuitive moral system, a system that favors people who are near us and look like us, is not always well-suited for our modern world. Matthew sees the downsides of our automatic mode all around us. He sees it in cases where men were aware of sexual harassment but didn't say anything, because the harasser was their friend. He sees it in family members who think they'll be supported regardless of what they do.
I think the sum total of all of our small partialities has added up to a lot of injustices in a lot of cases.
Both of our moral systems produce immense good, and both have serious shortcomings. Like a skilled photographer who changes her settings depending on the photo she wants to take, we would be wise to choose our moral settings deliberately. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
You can hear Shankar tackle other moral questions on his podcast, which explores so much that we do in automatic mode. It's called Hidden Brain. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King.
Supporters of WPR include Wisconsin Credit Union and White Winter Winery. You too can ensure the future of WPR programs by being a business sponsor. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor.
A special notice from WGTD. The Racine Art Museum has launched a new in-depth video series highlighting the works of clay artist Toshiko Takaizu, fiber artist Carol Eckhart, and more. Visit RAM's YouTube channel.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Class.